Taking Aim with
Rav Shonman
and Maya Shon, coming to you Tuesday, January 11th, 2005. Alberto R. Gonzalez, on January 25th, 2002, sent a memorandum to President Bush. As you said, Gonzalez wrote, the war against terrorism is a new kind of war. And it creates a new paradigm that renders obsolete the Geneva Conventions on Prisoners of War's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions. The memo had been written by Gonzalez in response to Secretary of State Colin Powell's objection to a 100-page memorandum that Gonzalez had sent originally to President Bush, in which he detailed why he considered the Geneva Conventions obsolete and why President Bush could do essentially anything he wanted with the prisoners taken in Afghanistan and later those sent to Guantanamo Bay, discarding the mask, official torture, and the state, our program for Taking Aim today. After the Gonzalez hearings for confirmation as the Attorney General of the United States that were held on January 6th, and also on Monday, January 10th, the opening of the trial of Specialist Charles Skranner, the first of the trials as a result of the revelations of what took place at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. Ralph?
Maya, the assessment of the hearings pertaining to Alberto Gonzalez and his nomination to be Attorney General of the United States is in essence an embrace of official torture and rendition and the abrogation of all legal restraints by the highest levels of authority in the United States. Joseph K., in the World Socialist Website assessment on the 7th of January, raises this very question. The nomination of Alberto Gonzalez for Attorney General marks a significant escalation in the assault upon all democratic rights in the United States. Perhaps more than any other figure, Gonzalez is identified with the most criminal actions of the Bush administration. As White House counsel, he developed the rationale for preemptive war, indefinite detention of detainees, and, most infamously, torture. But what's significant about this is that the determined effort to expand the power of the arbitrary presidency and to intensify an all-out discarding of constitutional rights and what passes for international law, Gonzalez, in explicitly addressing the justifications for this virtual embrace of the fascist concept of state power, will almost certainly be confirmed with support, as Joseph K. describes it, of large sections of the Democratic Party. The Judiciary Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee's confirmation hearings were concluded in less than one day. In fact, in this hearing, there were some nominal questions about the torture memo, but it in no way impacted the decision to confirm him. As the Democratic Senator from New York, Charles Schumer, put it, who serves on the Judiciary Committee, generally for an executive branch position, the president gets the benefit of the doubt, and the general feeling amongst us all is that Gonzalez has met that threshold. Now, this statement was made even as the White House was blocking the release of documents that implicate Gonzalez in the formation of openly criminal policies. And we have to be clear about this because it's criminal policies insofar as is it not just an embrace of torture, but the argument for the abandonment of the Geneva Convention and the enunciation of the doctrine that there are no restraints on the power of Bush or a president as long as he declares that there is a war concern. That includes the arbitrary detention of U.S. citizens. It includes the overriding of any constitutional prohibition or any law that intercedes with an intended action. in an open embrace of the arbitrary power of the presidency, torture is foremost amongst those entitlements.
Ralph, when Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, asked Gonzalez where the president, quote, can ignore a law passed by this Congress, signed by this president or another one, and decide that it is unconstitutional and refuse to comply with the law, end quote, Gonzalez asserted right away, without hesitation, quote, you are asking me whether hypothetically does that authority exist? And he went on to say, I guess that I would have to say that hypothetically that authority may exist. In fact, that is what Gonzalez told President Bush, that he had the authority as commander-in-chief to authorize warrantless searches of American homes, wiretaps of conversations in violation of criminal and foreign intelligence surveillance statutes, and also to abrogate laws to which the United States is an international signatory. Gonzalez later said, I would have to know what is in the national interest that the president may have to consider. This implies, of course, that the president has the power to make the decision, and Gonzalez is unequivocal about that. The president, in his opinion, has the authority when and where he pleases to do whatever he wishes to do.
Maya, this is how Senator Russ Feingold, a Democrat from Wisconsin, formulated the question. And I have to emphasize that, as with Schumer and the other Democrats, Feingold, having elicited the response I'm about to quote, was not in any way encouraged to oppose this nomination. So what we have here is a simple charade in which there is the putative questioning of the opinions of Gonzalez and the intentions of this White House, and then an embrace of that entitlement. Quote, what is your view regarding the president's authority to authorize violations of criminal law, of duly enacted statutes that are on the books for many years? Does the president have the authority to authorize warrantless searches of Americans' homes, wiretaps of their conversations, as Maya was citing, violation of the criminal and foreign intelligence surveillance statutes, and other constitutional and legal statutes and interdictions? And it is to that that Gonzalez stated that, in fact, that authority resides with the president at his discretion, that the president is above the law, and that the legal decisions made during the first term of the Bush administration, with Gonzalez at the head of the lawyers rationalizing it, were an example of that entitlement. In fact, the group of lawyers that included John Yoo, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department. It included Gonzalez's deputy, Timothy Flanagan, the Vice President's counsel, David Addington, and William Haynes, the General Counsel of the Department of Defense, all lawyers, by the way, associated with the right-wing Federalist Society, which openly advocates an arbitrary extension of vast character of presidential power. And by the way, these people were previously clerks for Supreme Court Justices Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, and were featured in the attempts to impeach Clinton on the grounds of his affair with Lewinsky, which places their origins politically. These were all people who provided a total justification for official torture and for discarding the Geneva Convention. In a memo dated August 1st, 2002, signed by Assistant Attorney General Jay Bybee, but written by you at the behest of Gonzalez, the contention was made that the president, as commander-in-chief, has the right to order the torture of detainees, regardless of whether this violates legal statutes. The Bybee memo defines torture in such narrow terms as to allow, as the Washington Post stated, anything to be done in the way of torturing prisoners, unquote. The Washington Post article of January 5th by Jeffrey Smith and Dan Egan says that the Gonzalez memo set the course for detainees and was a critical role in defining a torture memo that arose directly from a CIA request for clarification regarding how it might treat detainees.
Ralph, going again to the Washington Post and its article after the hearings Friday, January 7th, by Diane Egan and Jeffrey Smith, Gonzalez defends his White House record because in this article they state, these reporters state, that Gonzalez said he could not recall key details of his involvement in the production of the August 2002 memo that narrowly defined the tactics that constitute torture. Now, the Washington Post says that it narrowly defined, but if you look at the memo, you will see that this narrow definition is quite broad and allows just about everything. The interesting part of this article is the quote from Senator Joseph Biden, the Democrat from Delaware, because as Biden says, quote, "We're looking for you when we ask you questions to give us an answer which you haven't done yet." Note, saying directly to Gonzalez that he is evasive on significant questions, and these are the significant questions about the documents that set the stage for torture, open torture, because torture has been the modus operandi of U.S. policy. Many revelations from the Vietnam War and on, many in the International Tribunal on War Crimes and in subsequent tribunals by various organizations, and in documents that have been released, whether from El Salvador or actions of special forces in Nicaragua or in other parts of the world. And yet, here we have openly in the revelations of these torture documents and the revelations that have been coming out about Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, the direct notion that it is official U.S. policy, that it is not under the table. And yet, Gonzalez was evasive, but what was Biden's response to Gonzalez? Quote, "I love you, but you're not very candid so far," end quote. With the very statement, "I love you," Senator Joseph Biden, one of the major senators for the Democratic Party, here he is telling Gonzalez, "It's okay, we're going to support you all the way."
By the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, with the chairing of Gonzalez, spelled out in a detailed account of interrogation techniques the sorts of torture that were specifically authorized. Waterboarding, whereby a victim is submerged until they have the sensation of drowning or indeed drown, is specifically cited as a form of interrogation that is authorized. Sleep deprivation, placing prisoners in positions of extreme discomfort where they are, where their limbs are bent into positions that induce agonizing pain, explicitly authorized. Torture is a specific category which they actually spell out. They actually detail the forms of torture that are examples of what is approved, but do not exhaust what is approved. The torture memo of you was one of a series put out by Gonzalez and his cohorts. One of these, written on September 25, 2001, stated the president may deploy military force preemptively and is entitled to attack preemptively any state that harbors or supports those who can be linked with terrorists, and including states that cannot be linked to specific terrorist incidents. The power is unlimited. You stated the president was not required to provide proof that any country targeted by the United States for attack was involved in attacking the United States, even posed a threat to U.S. national security. In the, quote, "in the exercise of this plenary power to use military force, the president's determination and decision is for him alone and is unreviewable. Now, the critical role that Gonzalez played in arguing that the president has the inherent authority, quote, to order that an individual may be arrested, held without charges, tried in a military tribunal, and even executed without recourse to the courts within the United States or in any other country, was stated explicitly. Addington and Flanagan, on his behalf, drafted a November 13, 2001 executive order setting out these specific powers. And these decisions were not made behind the back of those of the highest authority, but they were concealed from the American people. Now, what we're dealing with here as we were saying, Gonzales himself authorized the January 25, 2002 memo urging that the Geneva Convention should not be applied to any prisoners captured in Afghanistan or Iraq. His position stated that the war against terrorism is a new kind of war, and the nature of this war places a premium on other factors such as our need to obtain information from those we capture and from their sponsors. In my judgment, the new paradigm renders obsolete Geneva's limitations on questions of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions.
Ralph, was not only the abrogation of the U.S. participation in the Geneva Conventions, Gonzales was concerned about a statute that was enacted by the United States in 1996 that was the War Crimes Act, 18 U.S.C. 2441, that prohibits the commission of a, quote, war crime by or against a U.S. person, including U.S. officials. And war crimes, for the purposes of this legislation, is defined to include any grave breach of the Geneva Conventions or any violation of what is called Article 3, that is, quote, outrages against personal dignity. And what Gonzales was specific in relating to President Bush was that the Geneva Conventions had to not shouldn't refer to either the prisoners taken in Afghanistan or other so-called terrorists, because we wanted to defend the U.S. forces and U.S. officials, such as President Bush, from a defense against prosecution today and against future prosecution. He says in one of his points, your determination would create a reasonable basis in law that Section 2441 does not apply, which would provide a solid defense to any future prosecution.
Maya, the conservative commentator Brian Foley on January 6th, in an article called A Contempt for Civil Rights, Supporting Torture is Not Gonzales' Greatest Sin. He writes the following. Gonzales' attempt to provide the president with the power to imprison Americans incommunicado and indefinitely without recourse or lawyers displays such contempt for basic civil rights that it is clear that Gonzales and those who hire him cannot be trusted to protect any rights of the American people. The White House, with Gonzales as legal advisor, has argued for the unchecked and arbitrary power of the presidency and of U.S. authority. And what is interesting about the role of Gonzales in relation to George Bush is that Gonzales was his principal legal advisor during his period as governor of the state of Texas, and in that capacity provided Bush with the rationale for over 130 executions, including a case in which the prisoner who was due for execution had been shown to be innocent, where the courts decided that in fact the evidence now demonstrated his innocence, and this was not considered to be sufficient to prevent his execution. In addition to which, Gonzales concealed the condition of mentally retarded, psychologically handicapped candidates for the death penalty, and oversaw with Bush their execution in Texas.
Ralph, I want to return a moment to Gonzalez and the powers that he proposes and gives to it. It provides the legal rationale for giving to the president. The Torture General is an article by Marguerite Fetlowitz that appeared in Salon.com on January 6th. Marguerite Fetlowitz is the author of The Lexicon of Terror, Argentina, and the Legacies of Torture, so you have an idea of where we're going in this article. She now teaches literature at Bennington College, and she writes, quote, I spent nearly 7 years interviewing survivors of the torture centers of Argentina's Dirty War, 1976 to 83, relatives of the desaparecidos, the disappeared, human rights experts and activists, peasants and labor leaders, in short, three generations of Argentines from all walks of life whose families were torn apart by the dictatorship. Torture is a crime that never ends. And she goes on to talk about Gonzalez and the situation today. Gonzalez cites the need for, quote, flexibility in what he calls a new kind of war. This line, as old as the hills, is the immemorable favorite of torturers and the powers they serve. Quote, this is a fight for Western Christian civilization, end quote, intoned the generals of Argentina's dirty war. And she goes on, quote, we believe in a country where the love of liberty and personal initiative will be great. We fight for the love of life, of respect of those who have fallen and will fall. She is quoting not the the people who rationalize World War IV, who we've quoted before, who come up like James Woolsey with a very similar line, or Alberto Gonzalez in supporting President Bush, and he has made statements such as this too. She is quoting the Argentine junta, the great orator, who she calls, of the Argentine junta, Admiral Emilio Massera, who later was convicted of numerous crimes against humanity and remains under house arrest in Argentina today. Ralph.
The Wall Street Journal, on January 6th, is openly in support of the advocacy of Gonzalez. White House favors Geneva Convention revisions, it cites Gonzalez on January 6th. He disclosed in Senate confirmation testimony that the White House was looking to change the Geneva Convention and to eliminate protection of war prisoner rights. And the journal in supporting this goes on to cite how the nomination of Gonzalez will be at the center of decisions about, quote, the legality of detention and interrogation methods that are tantamount to torture. Torture and abuse. The formal embrace. Not only of the Wall Street Journal, but of Gonzalez and of Bush and of the Democrats who give nominal process of questioning and then proceed to approve.
Ralph, the Wall Street Journal, in its editorial January 6th, the title is Torture Showdown, and they say that the Gonzalez hearings are a great chance, quote, for the administration to do itself in the cause of fighting terror some good by forcefully repudiating all the glib and dangerous abuse of the word torture. In other words, as you say, the Wall Street Journal is unequivocally in favor of codifying torture as U.S. policy. They say in this editorial that there's a fuss in some quarters. Imagine the word fuss. But that what was done with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda detainees is in accord with the language of the Geneva Conventions because they say that the Geneva Conventions require that soldiers be in uniform. The administration understood, the Wall Street Journal writes, what critics don't want to admit, namely that POWs may not want to be interrogated, period. And the Geneva Conventions prohibit even positive reinforcement, such as better rations to coax them to talk. The Wall Street Journal doesn't understand the Geneva Conventions, and in fact, it is going on to rationalize why torture is what they call the tolerable behavior for the U.S. forces. They refer to Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard law professor, who came into public attention after 9/11 for his statements that judges should issue, quote, torture warrants. In fact, Dershowitz said that it was hypocrisy for the United States not to legalize torture and to have judges issue warrant, because he noted that torture is in fact part and parcel of U.S. methodology throughout the world. Ralph?
Well, Maya Dershowitz has been beating the bushes to establish the entitlement to torture. Here he is on CNN being interviewed by Wolf Blitzer, in which he says torture is justified. My basic point is we should never allow low-level people to administer torture unless it has been openly embraced with accountability and approval by the President of the United States. And that is what we require. We don't know when a torture warrant will be unjustified. There's a heavy burden on the government, but it is necessary to allow the government to administer the horrible techniques of torture. A sterilized needle under the nail, which would violate the Geneva Conventions, is something that we know is done anyway. They do it secretly and hypothetically. We have to have open entitlement to carry out these activities.
In fact, the saturation bombing for Dershowitz should also be legalized, he states in this discussion with Wolf Blitzer. Of course, we've done that. This is in reference to torture, but he goes on, quote, we have bombed civilian targets during every single one of our wars. We did it in Dresden, referring to World War II. We did it in Vietnam, notwithstanding these rules. That is, the rules of the Geneva Convention. So you know, having laws on the books and breaking them systematically just creates disdain. It's much better to have rules that we can actually live within. And absolute prohibitions, generally, are not the kind of rules that countries could live within.
Well, Maya, on 60 Minutes, once again, Mr. Dershowitz on legal torture. After the events of September 11th, we had a series of ticking bombs. And a ticking bomb scenario involves a person who refused to tell what they know. And that is a case that warrants torture. Dershowitz cites the fact that the FBI leaked to the press a belief within the Bureau that torture is the only option. And then Dershowitz says the following. If anybody has any doubt that our CIA has taught people to torture, has encouraged torture, and has itself tortured in many cases, I have a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. And he goes on to say that Islamic terrorists and those who are suspected of the same are candidates for this, and that it requires a legal authorization. This defense of torture is orchestrated not only with Gonzalez and you and with the established media from CBS to CNN. Here in Front Page Magazine, an article by Henry Mark Holzer, November 29, 2002, called In Defense of Torture. Torture, defined as the inflicting of severe pain to force information or confession, comes in two varieties, physical and psychological. The literature on torture is voluminous, and in fact, our commentators don't take account of the fact that it is important, it is necessary, particularly with respect to the ticking bomb situation. Realists would acknowledge that free of even a scintilla of moral guilt, torture of whatever kind and no matter how brutal, in defense of legitimate self-preservation is not only not immoral, it is a moral imperative.
Ralph, the ticking bomb situation is always called up by those who defend torture, and in fact it is a bogus argument, as all people who have studied the effect of torture will tell you about what happens when people are subjected to torture. What's interesting about this article in defense of torture is that Holzer discusses the rationale not just for torture of so-called foreign enemies, but about torture that is taking place in the United States by the U.S. police force. And I'm not referring to here what takes place under the criminal justice system, as we discussed in Buried Alive, with isolation and with such things as the torture chair. What he's talking about here is what has been rationalized by the U.S. state courts in Florida and also federal courts of appeal. Quote, unknown to most American, one case in two different courts in the United States, a state appellate court in Florida and a federal court of appeals, have, albeit implicitly, endorsed a use of physical force and thus of torture if necessary to save lives. And he's referring to a case where the courts didn't have to as part of their judgment, but made statements that the police, in using chokeholds and twisting someone's arms, threatening him with death, physically abusing him, and choking him, they, in order to get him to release information, that the courts gave express approval of the physical and the psychological coercion in the situation. In fact, the statement was, quote, the force and threats asserted upon Leon, who was the person who brought the case, in the parking lot were understandably motivated by immediate necessity. And this was also made, a statement such as this was also made not only by the state court, but by a federal court of appeals.
Well, Maya, the theme is taken up on a constant basis. Here is Daniel Pipes, who is one of the authors of The Call for Permanent War in World War IV and is associated with the American Enterprise Institute and on the entire Jinsa and Likud apparatus within the so-called neocons in the United States. Here in the New York Post on January 24th, 2003, The Enemy Within. He addresses the necessity for enhanced security with respect to all Muslims. In the course of their assaults on Americans, Islamicists have killed nearly 4,000 people, and they're plotting to kill many more Americans, and Islamic terrorists do not appear spontaneously, but emerge from a milieu of religious sanction, intellectual justification, financial support, and organizational planning. These circumstances point to the imperative of focusing on Muslims. There's no escaping the fact that Muslim employees in law enforcement, the military, the diplomatic corps, and in all aspects of public life need to be watched on a constant basis. Muslim visitors, Muslim immigrants must undergo constant surveillance, and they must be singled out as such. He is explicit in talking about the necessity to round up an entire category of people based on their religion, and to spell that out in the New York Sun on December 28, 2004, he writes as follows. Why the Japanese internment still matters. For years, it has been my position that the threat of Islam implies an imperative to focus security measures on Muslims. If searching for rapists, one looks at the male population, and searching for Muslims, one looks at the suspect population. In fact, the treatment of ethnic Japanese resulted from legitimate national security concerns. And, in fact, the lobby that opposed it results from a combination of wartime hysteria, That's an interesting notion, turning the notion of wartime hysteria on its head. And the article in openly advocating the necessity to round up Muslims completely justifies the indiscriminate roundup of the Japanese, and he says to engage in loose talk about American concentration camps and the location of Japanese is in Spartan facilities, which in fact were very humane, is to oppose what is necessary for the security of the state. In times of war, we have to take into account nationality, ethnicity, and religious affiliation in our homeland security policies, engage in threat profiling, preventive detention, and that may entail bothersome or offensive measures, but they are preferable to being incinerated at our office desks by flaming hijacked planes.
Ralph, I think that it's important time and again to return to this notion of the category of terror, the war on terror, what Gonzalez refers to in his memo to President Bush of that January as a new paradigm. It is because of this that they say no holds barred. Even if there were any war, the abrogation of civil liberties, the abrogation of human rights are unwarranted. The war is against us. Let us be clear. The war is against the working people of the United States and the world. It is not a war against some mysterious other. And in terms of turning the table of what have been acceptable notions of propriety and of responsibility, a very important article appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I think we should discuss it now. It's called When Doctors Go to War, and it's by M. Greg Bloch, who's both a doctor and has a JD, the Doctor of Jurisprudence. He's a professor at Georgetown University, a law professor, and he's also at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. And he wrote this article with a British barrister who's a fellow in bioethics. His name's Jonathan Marks, and he also is at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. When Doctors Go to War is in the New England Journal of Medicine, January 6, 2005 edition. And it deals with the very notion of the transformation of the Hippocratic Oath, which is the basis of doctors' professionalism, and states that they are to treat humanely any person, be they an enemy prisoner or a soldier or anyone they come in contact with. These authors write, quote, "When military forces go into combat, they are typically accompanied by medical personnel, physicians, physician assistants, nurses, and medics who serve in non-combat roles. These professionals are bound by international law to treat wounded combatants from all sides and to care for injured civilians. They are also required to care for enemy prisoners and to report," note this, "any evidence of abuse of detainees." But Pentagon officials deny that this is so today. There are claims and there is proof, and the New England Journal of Medicine authors have substantiated the proof that physicians and other medical professionals have breached their professional ethics and the laws of war by participating in abusive interrogation practices. This is documented by the International Committee of the Red Cross, who concluded particularly that medical personnel at Guantanamo Bay shared health information, patient records with Army units that planned interrogations. The research that these authors conducted goes even further. They found out that not only the doctors participate share their information, but they actually devised and participated in interrogation procedures that they note violate all the laws of war. Ralph.
The disclosures in the New England Journal of Medicine are but the tip of the iceberg. Here is a report in Al Jazeera on the 20th of August, 2004. U.S. doctors aided Abu Ghraib abuses. The respected Lancet Weekly, the medical publication in Great Britain, in its latest issue, outlines a disturbing litany of medical involvement in the subject of detainees to torture. Medical personnel evaluated detainees for the interrogation, monitored the coercive interrogation, allowed interrogators to use their medical records to develop specific interrogation techniques, falsified medical records and death certificates, and failed to provide elementary health care to the victims. One of the most startling charges in the article by Stephen Miles of the University of Minnesota was that medical personnel collaborate with the military in designing and implementing psychological and physical methods of torture. Not only did the medical system, Miles writes, fail to report the injuries consequent upon this torture, but where U.S. soldiers were photographed abusing and sexually humiliating naked Iraqi prisoners, not only were the doctors present, but death certificates of prisoners held in U.S. custody, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, were falsified or their completion delayed for months, he reports. Medics inserted intravenous catheters into the corpses of detainees who died under torture to create evidence that they were alive at the hospital. One surgeon stated that the death of Iraqi Major General Muhush was of natural causes after his head was pushed into a sleeping bag while interrogators sat on his chest and he suffocated. It was 6 months later that it was disclosed that this was homicide by asphyxia. The U.S. Army's medical services are staffed by personnel who are engaged in facilitating of torture. Quote, the Army medics not merely failed to report the abuses of Abu Ghraib, but they had knowledge of torture and participated in the degrading treatment that was widespread within the system there.
Ralph, some of the documents, the original documents, can be read at the ACLU website. That's www.aclu.org, including one by Colonel Thomas M. Pappas, who was Chief of Military Intelligence at Abu Ghraib, and where he describes physicians' systematic role in developing and executing interrogation strategies. To go back to the rationale, such as Gonzalez provided for President Bush, in an interview conducted by the New England Journal of Medicine authors, Dr. David Tornberg, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, stated that in the Pentagon's opinion and how they act, not just their opinion, physicians are not bound by normal patient-oriented ethics. He stated, physicians assigned to military intelligence have no doctor-patient relationship with detainees, and in the absence of life-threatening emergency, they have no obligation to offer aid. In other words, they are no longer bound by the norms of their roles as doctors. So the Army says that it is obligatory for physicians to collaborate with the prison guards and the military interrogators, and that they are not stepping out of their role as physicians. It's not just physicians. It includes psychologists and psychiatrists, and in particular, it's been documented that they functioned at Guantanamo and participated in the interrogations in Guantanamo.
What we learn here as we study the implications not just of the Gonzalez memoranda and of the authentication and the vindication of torture was that it was with respect to not just the treatment of prisoners in Abu Ghraib, but across Iraq, across the Middle East, and in fact in Afghanistan, of course. Here is the new standard in a series of articles, the first of which is called Abuse, Torture, and Rape Reported in Unlisted U.S.-Run Prisons Across Iraq. The article cites on the 23rd of September American legal investigators have discovered widespread evidence of abuse, torture, and rape throughout the U.S.-run prison system across Iraq. A Michigan legal team meeting with detainees in Baghdad during a fact-finding mission gathered evidence supporting the claims of prisoner abuse at over 25 U.S. secret prisons and detention centers without publicity across the Iraqi landscape. The new standard continues. U.S. government media silent on torture of detained Iraqi children. Just as the U.S. This is an article of August 10, 2004. Just as the U.S.-led forces refused to release thousands of adult prisoners after the handover of so-called partial sovereignty, U.S. and U.K. authorities continue to incarcerate children who are subject to torture and rape. The article details the same. And on the 31st of December 2004, Iraq torture investigators reveal scores of new cases. American legal teams interviewing men and women in U.S.-run prisons throughout Iraq state new cases of abuse and court torture continue to stream in since an initial fact-finding mission to the country in August.
Ralph, it is almost 1 year ago. It was on January 14th that a U.S. soldier turned over the computer disk that contained the photos of prisoners being abused at Abu Ghraib. Now, these photos surfaced last April on CBS and in articles in The New Yorker by Seymour Hersh. But the Red Cross knew about this torture as soon as the U.S. invaded Iraq. An important article that I came across in our files is from the Wall Street Journal by Farnaz Fashihi and Steve Stecklow of May 21, 2004, Finding U.S. Abuse in Iraq Left the Red Cross Team in a Quandary. Now, it talks about the quandary because the Red Cross team uncovered prisoner abuse throughout Iraq. It says in the U.S.-run Iraqi prisons throughout the Iraq that included physical and psychological coercion that they considered torture, and that they spoke to the people in Iraq as well as to high U.S. military and civilian authorities right away and throughout the time, and the torture was to such an extent that there was much discussion within the Red Cross, which usually deals only with the governments themselves and doesn't make it public, that they had to take the step, and they did, a year ago, that is January 2004, of publicly complaining about treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo, the Guantanamo base in Cuba. And it was later on that the Wall Street Journal was able to obtain the official Red Cross document that dealt with what was going on with Iraq and made it public.
Maya, the article by Mark Danner in the New York Times on January 6th and the International Herald Tribune on January 7th is actually rather explicit. The headline is, "We are all torturers now." Americans had come to take for granted a certain storyline of scandal. Revelation is supposed to be followed by investigation, adjudication, and expiation. In fact, high-level wrongdoing, crimes charted, malfeasance documented, leads not to its removal, but to its justification. And he states, "The senators will give full legitimacy to a path that this administration has set the country on more than 3 years ago that has transformed the United States from a country that at least formally condemned torture and forbade its use to one that practices torture routinely. A process of redefinition largely overseen by Gonzalez himself, a practice that once was a clear and abhorrent violation of the law, has in fact become the law of the United States." And the article, which is somewhat detailed, spells out how that application is applicable to all facets of the judicial system in this country.
Ralph, it would take more than our 1 hour show. In fact, it would take 24-hour marathon to deal with the incredible documentation that is now available on the Internet. The New York Times prepared a guide to the memos on torture that evolved with the official Gonzales releases, and you can find that on the New York Times website. And it includes the documentation that was released by both the New York Times, Newsweek, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. As well, they refer you to the incredible thousands and thousands of pages that the ACLU was able to get through its Freedom of Information a lawsuit against the government. Some of these include the memorandum on the New York Times website that they refer you to, is the Justice Department memos by John Yoo and Albert Gonzales that we've discussed, the letter from Secretary of State Colin Powell, the memorandum from the Defense Department by William H. Taft IV, that's the State Department's legal advisor, and then also there are the Defense Department memos on torture. Ralph?
John Crudson, the Chicago Tribune, the 9th of January, mysterious jet tied to torture fights. The first question is, where is Leonard T. Bayard? The next question is, who is Leonard T. Bayard? The most important question is, does Leonard T. Bayard even exist? Because the signature of a Leonard Thomas Bayard appears on the annual report of a Portland-based company, Bayard Foreign Marketing LLC, filed in August with the Oregon Secretary of State. According to federal records, Bayard Foreign Marketing is the newest owner of U.S.-registered Gulfstream executive jets used to transport suspected al-Qaeda operatives to countries such as Egypt and Syria, where they are tortured routinely. The Central Intelligence Agency declines to discuss the plane, but retired CIA officers acknowledge that the Gulfstreams have been operated by the Joint Special Operations Command, an interagency unit that organizes operations in conjunction with the Central Intelligence Agency and military special forces in every country of the world. Bayard, no resident address, no telephone number, no social security, proprietorial operations, jet planes of a private nature, taking prisoners and those who are rounded up on a regular basis on without any formal entitlement to protection of rights, disappeared into torture chambers across the planet by the Central Intelligence Agency. The first mention of the Gulfstream appeared 6 weeks ago when a Pakistani newspaper reported that Jamil Qasim Saeed Mohammed, a microbiology student at Karachi University, had been spirited aboard the plane at Karachi Airport by Pakistan security officers. This is a process that the Chicago Tribune documents in country after country. It is supplemented by an article of great importance called The Salvador Option in Newsweek on January 9th. The Pentagon is putting special forces led assassination and kidnapping teams in Iraq. What to do about the deepening quagmire in Iraq? The Pentagon's latest approach is called the Salvador Option that is being discussed as a measure of how to deal with the quagmire in Iraq. The Pentagon is intensively debating the option that dates back to a still secret strategy in the Reagan administration's battle against leftist guerrilla insurgencies in El Salvador. Faced with a losing war against Salvadoran rebels, the U.S. government supported death squads that hunted down and killed rebel leaders and sympathizers and those in the general population. The El Salvador option, the Salvador option, in this detailed article in Newsweek, taking place inside with the plans for it through intensive discussions in the Senate Intelligence Committee, prepares for the application of death squads, assassinations, and targeting of the civilian population, the Salvador option, for Iraq, the Salvador operation for the United States. And indeed, Maya, in the Washington Monthly, Guerrillas in the Mist, What the Pentagon Can Learn from the Green Berets. Founded a half century ago, these Green Berets, named for the distinctive headgear that they wore, will engage in secretive activities across the world, special forces operations.
In fact, they have been functioning in Iraq, as they have been in Afghanistan, and this article, which is a review of the new book called Masters of Chaos, that celebrates the Green Berets, goes into some detail about this information. Ralph, this is time to sum up.
Well, in summing up what we're talking about in the embrace of the torture state is the application of the methods of torture not only to those detained in Iraq, not only to these in Afghanistan, but the formal entitlement to visit this fate upon American citizens. The Salvador option was applied across Latin America. As you mentioned, Maya, the International Tribunal on War Crimes in Indochina documented precisely the functioning of these special forces, the Delta Force, the Green Berets, across Vietnam and Indochina. The American people, the working people of this country, no less than the working people of Iraq, are targeted by the criminal state, the torture state. It is no longer wearing a mask. It formally acknowledges what it does. It is embraced in the Senate. It is embraced in the press. It is stated openly as to intent. The highest levels of authority in the land are the open authors of these proposals and these practices, Gonzalez and Bush. It is not only they. It is the entire apparatus of rule in this criminal government that calls itself the government of the United States.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Discarding the Mask, Official Torture and the State, will be up on our website, www.takingaim.info. You can reach us at 707-552-9995 or contact us by email at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim@wbai.org. We'll be with you next week.